Me Slater, Reel 2. Yes, you were telling me about your father's escape.
Yes, so sadly, two of the sappers that were in Daddy's unit weren't allowed to get on the destroyer because I think they were mostly senior army personnel. And so Noel Corrie, who we knew very well, sadly was torpedoed. And he was a very brave chap, and he gave up his place, I think, to somebody in one of the boats and died. They were there for hours and hours. I think there were only a handful picked up eventually. So Daddy was very lucky, and he made Trincomalee. And again, because he'd also been in Italy and he could speak Italian, there was an Italian prisoner unit, and they were very good engineers. And so Daddy took that over, and I think they all went to Madras. And so, Daddy spent most of his war there, with a little bit in the north of India, attached to the Indian Army, but British sappers. And so there he was for that time.
Mm-hmm. This was, you know, a very sort of dramatic time for you.
Yes.
That message about the Repulse and the Prince of Wales, can you remember the sort of atmosphere engendered?
Yes,
by
I think there was this, I think, as I said, this extraordinary feeling, well, that's it. Really, it was a feeling of doom. I can't explain it exactly. I think we were so horrified because there was this build-up of these two enormous ships having arrived out to, you know, shelter Singapore, as you might say, guard Singapore, to go down so quickly. Now, long afterwards, when I got married, my sister-in-law was married to a man called Captain Goodenough, Michael Goodenough, who was on the Prince of Wales. And it's funny, isn't it, how long afterwards, in the book on the fall of Singapore, by this man called Montgomery, on Shenton Thomas, it mentions my brother-in-law, who was at that meeting when Admiral Phillips decides to go. And he wrote a letter, which again my sister-in-law had long afterwards, to a man in London at the Admiralty, a friend of his, and said, "This is the biggest mistake." And he said, "What could I say?" He was only, he probably wasn't even a captain then, he was probably just a commander. But he said, I felt it was wrong. Our radars weren't. We had a suspect radar which was not working. But anyway, this is all history and it comes into the books and things. But it's funny that at that time, you know, eventually I should meet my sister, my brother-in-law, who was on that boat. Mm-hmm. There's small things in the world.
Yes, do you remember, you know, before the Japanese started their bombing in December, whether there was any particular view or feeling about the Japanese? And was there any threat perceived at all in Singapore?
No, they're not really. Probably I was too young. You see, I wasn't 18. And I think somehow these things didn't really come into it very much. And probably people I mixed with were all probably fairly young. And probably, I think if probably Daddy had been there, I might have had more, inkling of what might be ahead and so on. Though I will say it for again, I mean, one did feel that there was something probably brewing, but somehow there wasn't the emergency engendered as you might have thought there would be. And as I say, I think being very young, somehow you don't take these things on board. I was probably having a good time. And, you know, you're so resilient when you're young, you can't believe anything really awful is going to happen to one.
When you were evacuated, was your boat very crowded? You know, were other people leaving?
No, that was the extraordinary thing. Our captain said he could have taken many more. Again, you see, I blessed Daddy because we left at such a good time. And the captain said he could have taken many more families, women and children, many, many more. And you see, when you think later on, probably 3 weeks later on, most of those children and women who died at these small ships would need never have happened if they'd been evacuated. But nobody, you see, had taken the initiative of seeing that most of these women and children had gone. And as I say, it was entirely Daddy who had been a realist, realized that he wouldn't be happy till we had gone, which is understandable. There's another very nice family, two boys and their mother. They'd been planters up north, and they and my brother, you see, they all joined school. They were at school together. When we got there, they joined my brother's school. So we all kept in touch from then on, which was nice.
Did you suffer any bombing once you were on the ship?
No.
Because it's quite a way, isn't
quite
it?
Quite a way. Mm. No, I think we were just in good time.
What was the scene in the harbour when you left?
That was pretty awful because there was a raid going on. And, of course, we were only allowed a small suitcase and there was, you know, difficult getting through into the docks and all the rest of it, as you can imagine. Daddy eventually got us to the gangplank and saw us up and said goodbye, which was terrible for Mother, as you can imagine. Mummy and I had a very nice cabin with, I think, there were three other women and two children, but all very civilized. We really couldn't complain. Food was normal. And we were just very lucky. But they weren't so lucky later on, you see. So, as I say, we reached Fremantle with our one little suitcase. but very soon, Mummy, of course, had been down, you see, to put my brother to school, so knew roughly what Perth was like and managed to get a flat. So we moved in there. Elizabeth was on another ship. She had not such a good ship. But she eventually turned up in Fremantle. She'd been evacuated by the RAF. By that time, she was married to an RAF man. And he, of course, being in touch with Daddy and us, said, yes, Liz must go. Sadly, 2 days after we left, he was killed in a bombing raid in Kuala Lumpur. And Elizabeth, when she got down to Perth, West Australia, found she was expecting a baby, so he never knew about the baby. When I got down there, I met an awfully nice girl, Australian girl, and I think her father was the bank manager. And she had, at that time, joined a thing called the WANS, which was Women's Auxiliary National Service. And we were sent to orchards and, you know, apple orchards and farms to help. So in the meantime, I had put my name down for the army, which I really wanted to do, but this filled the time. And I turned up the farm with Elwyn.
This was in the Perth area, was it?
Yes, a place called Bridgetown, a little bit further west than Perth, which was absolutely fascinating. I've got a letter wrote to Daddy saying it's the climate was so amazing because early in the morning it was very cold. We were up at 6 and our jobs was to pump water up from the wells, to feed the chickens, collect the rabbits in traps round about, which seemed to be, we lived on rabbits, and set the traps down by the river for a funny little sort of, I suppose there were shrimps or that kind of thing. And then back up for breakfast at 8 o'clock. And then we got the horse and got the cart and all our boxes. And then out into the orchards, complete with our bags. Well, by midday, of course, it was absolutely boiling. It was up in the 90s, if you can imagine. I think the most lovely thing was the birds, these enormous coloured cockatoos and budgerigards and if you can imagine parrots, I mean. And the other thing along the river was these pelicans, which I found fascinating. We used to go down in the evening and swim in the river, and these pelicans just watching us and flying about. It was fascinating. So I think I was there for about 2 months. Mm-hmm. And then I managed my call-up papers, mm-hmm. came through.
This scheme, the ones, was it like the Women's Land Army?
Yes, it was. It was the same equivalent of it, must have been. Because some of these, as you can imagine, with manpower going, they needed the extra help. And we were taught how to pack the apples and grate them and everything. Which it was great fun. I mean, I thoroughly enjoyed it. It was hard work. I used to fall into bed at night at about 8 o'clock, exhausted. And of course, she was very economical, Mrs. Abbott's. And so we lived in rabbit in every conceivable way. From your man, roasted and stewed and curried and everything. nevertheless, we're well fed.
Did you have a uniform, rather like the Land Army?
No, we just had dungarees. No, we had no uniform, just dungarees, really, and large hats.
Were you paid? Did you have pay as well?
It might have been paid, but I can't remember it being very much. But we were paid. And then, as I say, my call-up papers for the army came through, so...
Yes. How did the Australians regard you when you arrived? Was there any anti... British feeling?
There was a certain amount, and of course one was called pommies till they realised I was a Scot, and then of course it's quite a different thing. So then I was always known as Scotty. But no, I think on the whole they weren't bad. I think they were very suspicious, funnily enough, of us evacuees. There was a certain amount of feeling because so many of us arriving down in a place like Perth, and it wasn't easy to assimilate to begin with.
Was there any worry about Japanese attacks?
Not just then. By the time I got into the army, and I was posted to the cipher unit, then of course we did begin to realise how close the Japs were, and that was very interesting because these, as you could imagine, these messages and things coming through that we had to decipher were showing very much what was happening. And of course there was a bombing raid on Geraldton and things at that time. But Perth, no.
What was the procedure for joining? You were in the Australian Army, were you?
Yes, I joined in Perth, West Australia. And I became, what did they call us? I can't remember. I think they called us gropers because it was full of sand. So they were, I don't know why West Australian females were called gropers. So we were WF, West Australian females. And we went for our medical. And then there weren't very many of us, funnily. It must have been about 20 of us. And we joined a troop train. We had no training or anything in Perth. We joined this troop train, and we were supposed to be joining this signal school, which was started in Melbourne. And so off we went in this train, which was bare necessities. We used to be shunted into a siding, and when we clambered down from the train with our tin mugs and plates, and the food was given to us then. We used to try and get into the shade of the carriages, as you can imagine. When we were allowed 40 minutes in Kalgoorlie, which is a famous little place, my old mining town. I remember dashing to the little hotel to have a shower and buying some oranges, and then clambering back onto the train. Luckily, we did have a wash basin in the carriage with us, and we used to wring out our flannels to put over our faces because, as you can imagine, no air conditioning. It was so hot. When we got into the Nullarbor Plain before Adelaide, we found the most terrible stench, which was a rabbit's dying along the track for lack of water. It was most extraordinary. But then we reached Adelaide. I suppose we must have had a good night on that train or two. And then we had to get onto another train because the railway gauge changes at Adelaide. And so we were on another train to Melbourne. Melbourne large trucks met us, and we were whisked to what had been taken over was the Ivor Grammar School. I think it was Grammar School. Ivanhoe Grammar School, that was it. And we were in wooden huts, which I suppose were put out for us, and about 20 to a wooden hut, and got our sheets and uniform, and we had to stuff our mattresses, you won't believe this, with straw, good old palliasses. We did have metal beds, and that's what we put on top, and we were issued, as I say, with sheets and blankets, and a hard pillowcase. Which was great fun. Somehow you took it all. We had route marches all round the streets, round the roads round there. People were terribly kind to us, and they'd started a canteen. So we used to go in the evening and, you know, have sausage rolls and buns and coffee and tea. They were very good to us. We had a hilarious time there and learnt. And then, as I say, being signals, we were sort of segregated and put into different units. And I was in the signal unit. So we were learning then, not Morse code, but decoding of different kinds. And eventually, when they thought we knew enough, I was posted to Second Army in Sydney. That, we were, which was a lovely spot. We were way out on a golf course, and billeted in tents, which was all right during the day. But if you came off night duty, as you can imagine, with the temperature soaring into 80s and 90s, it was not easy to sleep during the day. And we lived in those tents for 2 years, yes, which was quite a long time. But again, you accepted it, and we used to go our leave into Sydney and take the boat from Parramatta. Of course, there was no beautiful, opera house then. And we used to go out to Mandalay and swim and spend the day when we were on leave. Which, again, very nice girls. We were a mixed lot.
Yes, I was going to ask you, who were you with? What were they mainly Australians?
Oh, all Australians. But a very mixed lot, as you can imagine. Some were straight from the outback. And, I mean, there were two girls who smoked pipes, which was quite amazing. And of course, they were a bit wild, some of them. And the sergeant on duty, I became a sergeant, I suppose, because of signals, because of ciphers. And our duty at night was to go do our roll call to see everybody was in the tents and in, and he would do his. So anybody was missing, we found they were invariably coupled up in the bunkers on the golf course. We used to people thought, get them back to their tents. It was extraordinary. But I had very happy memories of it all. And there was a lovely park nearby with the koala bears and things, which was a lovely little oasis we used to make for that and take our picnic lunch and things with us.
Could I ask you to describe your uniform? This would be very interesting comparing it with the British.
Probably very similar to the English one, except that they weren't a battle dress. It was a proper tunic and skirt, a sort of A-line skirt. And very nice shirts, creamy-coloured khaki shirts and ties, khaki ties. And rather what I call sort of pork pie hats with our badge, front and badges on. Then for every day we had what we called our giggle dress, which was just a sort of khaki cotton dress which you mucked about and you could do what you liked in. It wasn't, well, in fact we worked in those because in that heat you could imagine we probably had two or three of those because washing facilities for our clothes was not easy. there was a large copper that we used to take it in turns to boil up our sheets and things. Washing machines, as you could imagine. Large line, so a good bit of scrubbing by hand, and then out onto a line and ironing. So we did all that ourselves, and of course, yeah. But again, we used to go into Sydney, looking very smart. I got photographs of me going into Sydney. And in those days, the great thing was to go and have your hair done, and that became civilized. Then we always went to a nice hotel and had a civilized lunch, and it felt normal again, and then back to camp.
Did you have to wear stockings?
Yes, we did. But in the summer, of course not. We just had socks and shoes. I can't remember anything particular about the shoes. I don't know whether they were sandals or not. I can't remember. Probably if I looked at my photographs, I might see it.
Oh, and were there regulations about hair and
no,
makeup?
No, funnily enough, not too bad. No, makeup, there are no regulations. Hair probably was kept a fairly normal sort of length. Certainly, I remember mine was sort of turned up at the back, you know, with a bit in front. Typical of that time, 4 years. And, you know, you sort of tied it up in a bandeau and a scarf to get it out of the way. And we just wore blue and white armbands, which is actually what I wore when I worked at Fort Canning. That's all I had to show who I was. That and, of course, naturally, what you call it, a pass with my photograph and name on it and things. But that was all, really. Not a lot of uniform.
Well, was it a very different culture in Australia from, say, Scotland and what you had been used to
in
England?
Yes, probably it was. Again, I think because I was so young, it was probably easier to fit in. And as I say, the girls were terribly nice, and the men we worked for were a nice crowd. A lot of them actually had come back from the Middle East, so that they were fairly senior, you know, army people, because they'd had their time out there. And I think they'd been sent back because of the Jap situation, probably, from the Middle East. And so that they were sort of what I call much more of the regular army. So that they were a very nice crowd. And one respected them and they respected us. There was no undue sort of pressure on us or anything. No, I think I look back and very happy times, really.
Was some discipline rather tight, you know? How did you find that?
Yes, isn't it funny? I can't think of it being... We didn't seem to have many women officers there. I can only think of one woman who was awfully nice. We didn't have much of... I think, again, great thing was keeping everything sort of rather spick and span around our tents. And so that was part of our duties, was to see that they were all for inspection. But it was usually, funnily enough, a male officer inspection. I can't remember women officers very much there at all. But they would come round, having done the men's group of tents, and then come on to ours. And that was very strict. You stood, you know, at attention outside your tent, and he would see that it was all in good order and tidy and everything else. And then, of course, we did have parades when you had inspection parades.
Could I ask you a little more about your work?
Yes.
You know, this would be mainly decoding, you say.
Decoding, yes.
We had
two lots. We had the Playfair system.
Playfair?
Playfair, which was letters. And the other, which was five... numerals, and from a book you what you call subtracted the whole time, which gave you the sum, which you looked up again in your book. It gave you the word and things. Some, of course, you by that time you got to know the number meant so and so, and you followed that. I'm afraid it's so long ago that I can't give you much more detail of that.
How did the messages come?
Probably teleprinter. and Morse, of course.
So you would have been skilled in both of these, would you?
Well,
you...
Morse wasn't so good. I didn't do much in Morse, but so that was probably taken down in Morse and then came to us for decoding. So there was a slightly separate unit, but in near enough, you know, so that they would take the Morse in, come to us, and then we would decode what they'd taken down.
And these would all be very top secret, would they?
Yes, they would, yes. Yeah.
Yes. Do you remember any particular messages coming through?
I think the biggest one was that the Somado Japs of Geraldton and North Australia. That I thought, you know, I thought, oh God, you know, here we go again, sort of feeling about it. But again, I suppose being in Sydney, somehow you couldn't believe, you know, I don't think I really thought there was going to be any problems, but nevertheless, I thought that it was near enough with the Japs taking all those islands to see. That was what was so scary, how near they got with all those islands being taken.
Australia is a very big country, isn't
very
it?
Very big country.
But you know, was one aware of this, the immense size of it?
Yes, I think having travelled across it, you did. I never got up to Brisbane or Queensland. So I said I'd like to have done that. I found a distant cousin of Daddy and Mummy's. Daddy's, I think it was, a Duncan. Lived outside Sydney. I don't know how he got to know about me, but they contacted me and I went out to the sheep station they were on, and that was interesting. And a nice second cousin, I think, of Daddy's. But otherwise, I don't know, you made your own fun and things.
Was there any possibility of going abroad, being posted?
Not from there, no.
I suppose it would have been...
I got leave, and I went back to Perth on leave. I suppose it must have been a year after I was there. I had a short leave, and my sister's baby had been born in the meantime. So that was fun, and I saw my brother. And then back again to Sydney. And then I must have had about another year then. And then they posted me to Perth, West Australia, with the signals. I don't know whether I asked for that posting. I probably did. And I lived at home with my mother. In the meantime, my brother had managed to join the British Army and was posted to Bangalore for training, officer's training, OTC, in Bangalore, and joined a Gurkha unit. So he must have been 18, I suppose, just a young thing, 18, 19, I suppose, about that.
And were you in touch with your father at all? You know, could you...
Yes, by that, luckily, the relief when we had eventually, you know, a letter from... In fact, we had a cable from Daddy. I can't remember now what he said. It was some cryptic thing, which Mummy eventually realised where he was, because I suppose he couldn't say very much. And I can't remember sadly now what the message was that Mummy got, that we knew Daddy was all right. And that was terrific relief.